Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Suggest you shut up and show more football.
Come on, come on. Pick it. We've done that f***ing. Can we not knock it?
I am flabbergasted. I wouldn't even let him on the bus after the match. I get a taxi back to Manchester.
Again, please don't call me arrogant, because what I'm saying is true. I think I'm a special one.
When the seagulls follow the troll, it's because they sink sardines. Will be thrown into the sea. Thank you.
I understand what I'm trying to get at. Yes, he was a great player. Yes, he was a wonderful leader. But he wasn't a magician.
I'll take him out, son. I mean that. Take him.
So, are we comfortable? That's the first question. I have tea. Andrew, do you have tea?
Yeah, Mrs. Gray's just making me a cup of tea. She'll be bringing it in a couple of minutes, yeah, so we can crack on.
And I know that you would be making your own tea, were you able to, but I know because of the fact that you're laid up at the moment with a dodgy Bertie, you're not able to do that. So,
exactly.
Anyway, let me continue with more of what we would expect to hear at this point, having just...
Yes.
Tuned into this podcast. Welcome all. This week saw reaction to an incredible set of revelations from a particular interview, which subsequently prompted upset, some major reaction on the social media, and of course the mainstream outlets. The establishment has been rocked, and things they say, Andrew, may never be the same again. I am, of course, talking about our interview with Paul Lambert last week.
We rocked the foundation.
No. I jest. It's a cunning way in touching what's been happening in the UK this past week.
Okay.
My name is Richard Keys.
And my name is. I don't like upset anybody. Andy Gray. You know me.
I do know you. Of course, I know you. This is Keys and Gray, the podcast, and welcome. And before we go any further, I think it's only right and proper to say congratulations to Rangers.
Yes.
After 10 long seasons, Steven Gerrard has delivered the first for Newco. Mm. So congratulations, Steven.
No.
Very well
done. He's delivered the 55th league title, national title, which makes us world champions. No other team in the world has won as many domestic titles as the mighty Rangers. There you go. You can carry on now, fella.
We must also doff our caps to Glenn Roeder, sadly, who we lost this past week. I mean, a really nice man, Andy. There aren't too many what I would describe as nice people in football. I don't like the word, but it sometimes has to be used. Thoughts with him, family, friends. Just a thoroughly engaging individual. Wanted to give of himself, Andy, more to others than he would gain himself. We miss you, Glenn.
Yeah.
Thanks to all our new listeners. You can follow us on Insta and Twitter at Keys and Gray Pod, A-N-D, Keys and Gray Pod. Please do subscribe on whatever platform you get your pods on. Share and tell others who maybe are not listening at the moment. I don't know what we said last week, Andy, but we've had a particular spike in new listeners in a place synonymous with glamour and glitz, which I suppose... Well, actually, a place that you used to frequent quite a lot
when
we were in the UK.
Okay, go on. Give me a clue.
In the Med, you might go here to watch a movie or park a yacht. The Côte d'Azur.
Are we talking Cannes by any chance?
Well, I hope so. And if anybody in Cannes is listening and is looking for a couple of holiday guests, I mean, obviously, we'd be very, very happy to join.
Love it down there. Beautiful. Beautiful part of the world.
Right, now, you're going to have to indulge me here just for a minute, because I want to read you something from, where are you, Martin Ziegler, from The Times.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. The headline, Andrew, is Clubs Set to Review VAR Offside Criteria. And I want to read this whole article to you because I think it's fascinating. Premier League clubs are set to force through changes to the league's VAR protocols at their annual meeting in June after discontent about the way the system has been used. Club insiders say that marginal offside decisions are especially unpopular. Well, who knew? And expect to be reinforced by a survey of players, coaches, managers and executives this week. Some club chairmen have been looking enviously at the Netherlands, where the Eredivisie has been using its own VAR offside protocol, which means offsides have been significantly more obvious to be given. So why do we need VAR? Mm-hmm. Would be my first question.
Me too.
More obvious, strictly speaking, FIFA's VAR protocols do not allow such latitude, but the Dutch have been doing it anyway, which of course they would, because they're Dutch.
They're Dutch.
A Premier League insider, we will take the feedback and act on it, although clearly we want to be in line with VAR rules. Of course we do, if it survives. Mm-hmm. Mike Riley, the managing director of the PGMOL, the organisation that oversees elite referees and video assistants, has asked to be kept updated about developments. He's asked to be kept updated. Are you serious?
I know.
Really? I know. Anyway, the survey will also ask for views on VAR systems' handling of serious foul play and challenges in the penalty area. Yep. Mm-hmm. Handball decisions won't be part of the survey because the law, of course, has recently been changed. So,
again,
no need to go down that route. Back to where we were would be my view. Yeah. Exactly where we were.
Yeah.
Referee's discretion.
Yep.
Because you can't find perfection in these decisions.
Nope.
A VAR's only supposed to be used for clear and obvious decisions. But as those are often subjective, well.
Yeah.
What did I say for 18 months leading up to this, that a clear and obvious error becomes subjective in the blink of an eye?
Of course it does.
Yes. So it's led to controversy over a number of incidents. Of course it has. The most recent one happened Wednesday evening when Phil Foden was tripped by Alex McCarthy. How's that not a pen, Andy? How's that not a pen?
Pass.
In the win, City's win over, John Moss, the match referee, viewed a replay and decided the Southampton keeper had got a slight touch of the ball, said there was not enough of a reason to overturn the original decision.
Get off, Mossy.
Yes, there was.
Yeah, get off.
They want a clear and obvious error, said Pep Guardiola. That was. The referee got it wrong. It's obvious to everyone that there has been contact. Now, listen, I close a paragraph or two from the end of that article by asking, what is Mike Riley being paid for? If we're now turning to the 20 members of the Premier League to say, please help us, this is a mess. How can that be?
Well, it can be. Mike Riley is being paid for making a complete pig's ear of something that has been introduced into the game. Whether they think it was thought through or not, it wasn't. It's blatantly obvious it wasn't. He continues to fudge everything. He ducks criticism. He has no idea of leadership. He has made our referees poorer than they've ever been, less talented than they've ever been, as ineffective as they've ever been. And Mike if he set out to do that, then what I would say to Mike Riley, well done, Mike. You've mission accomplished. But it's been an absolute... Listen, Richard, we were voices in the wilderness 2 years ago, you and I.
Yes.
We never liked it. Yes. I never thought we could. And all the things we pointed out then have come home to roost.
Yes.
And I've never seen so many people now anti-VAR than they are now. Never.
It hasn't helped. I can't think of one constructive element that it has brought that you sit back and say, do you know what? I'm glad we brought that in. Because for me, there isn't one. And I really underline only what you said. We did say this. And let's never forget that Mike Riley and his officials were a year behind everyone else. They had a year to get it right before we put it into action.
I know.
And they still can't. And you hear things like, oh, well, it'll take us 3 years. 3 years?
I know.
Are you mad? For me, the best option, get rid. I know we're not going to because too many people have invested too much money and time. So now we've got to use it correctly, and we're not using it correctly.
But you say we're not using it correctly. Do you actually believe? Do you actually believe we can find a way where everybody turns around one day and says, you know what? This is it. This is how it should be used. I don't think there is.
No, I don't.
I don't think there is.
Because matters of fact, I repeat, become subjective in the blink of an eye. And that's the problem, that you cannot have perfection. You cannot achieve the consistency they thought they could. It's absolutely impossible to do that. And I a little line you used last week, football is a sport, not a science. And that is so true. And I shall keep repeating that line again and again and again. But three things that would make it better for me straight away. One, get rid of Mike Riley. His time is done.
It needs new leadership. Absolutely. It needs a new
Without
voice.
Question.
It needs
Refresh
new
the
ideas.
Leadership.
It needs something.
Two, have specialist VAR operators, not match day officials, in their cozy club. Specific VAR operators that start to understand that watching football on television is different. So VAR specialists. And thirdly, we must be allowed to listen to the conversation between the referee and Stockley Park. Something else we said 6 months ago, start of this season. And I was told, never happen. It'll never happen. Now, it might not ever happen, but there's momentum now.
Yeah,
a lot of people are asking for it. And I don't see why football fans should continue to live in the dark when it comes to watching their game being played in front of them. And that two or three people can affect the livelihoods of men in a secretive club, which is what it is at the moment. We want to hear that audio, and there's no good reason why not, unless you're covering something up.
Yeah, unless you've got
then
something
I understand
to hide.
Why you don't want to
if
stay
you've
here.
Got nothing to hide, I agree with you. You've been consistent in your views about this, but we must hear it for long enough now. And there is no good reason. I can't think of a good reason that we can't hear it unless they have something to hide. That's the only reason that they would not allow us to listen in to what the referee and the VAR operatives are discussing. There's no reason not to.
None at all. Martin Samuel in the Mail. Sit up, all you Newcastle fans, those of you who are already waving your fist and in frustration. Almost certainly some of the things that have been said already. A small paragraph from Sammy today. Mike Ashley's regime at Newcastle has, as we know, taken the club to lows never previously imagined. So it was no surprise to read this week that under his ownership, the average league position is a desperate 14th during his time, Andy. Compared to the 70 years prior to Ashley, when Newcastle's average finish was a mighty 17th. Interesting too, says Sammy, that players are frustrated at being given time off and not being made to work harder in training.
Yeah, no.
If they want to run around more, of course, they could always try it in matches.
Correct.
Starting tonight, Friday, against Aston Villa.
Yeah. Very good, Sammy.
I did like that. And also this week, before we get round to talking to our guest, piece from Crossy in the Mirror. The most debated goal in World Cup history. It has to be Jeff Hurst's, does it not?
Yes. Absolutely. World Cup final, all the drama, the closeness of the game.
I can now, after all these years, despite your manipulation of the pictures.
I never manipulated them.
Yes, you did.
I don't. No.
Yes, you did.
I didn't, because I wasn't techie enough and au fait with the technology to be able to manipulate it. I just said to the guys, I said to them, here are the pictures. Can you show me if this ball was over the line? And categorically, they come back and says, Andy, Sir Jeff's goal was not over the line. I thought that.
Well, we all know it was. That's the first thing. I would point out that our technology wasn't as good as today's. And we're questioning whether it's accurate even now. But, I can confirm for the English that Jeff Hurst's shot did cross the line. And we know that now because few people had a better view of Hurst's goal than Keith Waldron, one of eight Boy Scouts working as messengers for photographers on the day. He's 71 now. He's been tracked down to Australia, and he said, I had a great view of Jeff's goal. From the angle that we looked at, it definitely looked in.
Well, there you go. There's a flaw in his argument already. from the angle we looked at. See, he was not right in line with it. So I'm sorry. What was his name again? Easy.
Keith Waldron.
Keith. Well, Waldron. Listen, Keith. Yes. I mean, as Richard and I know, age is a terrible thing for your memory. And I can tell you, from my angle, it was definitely not him.
I should, in the interests of fair play, continue that quote where he says, but you can't really be sure.
Yeah, there you go. I love it. Yeah, you know what I think about it now, when you say that probably is the most talked about. Are we sort of insular? And I thought about that because the World Cup was in England and because England won it, that we think that that's the most important goal. Or if we kind of step out of that, is there another goal you can think of that would create as much debate?
No. 2-2 at the time. It's the goal that was going to win it until Jeff Hurst cracked in that fourth. After the gloriously cultured piece of football by Bobby Moore.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason that we're talking about this is that is the direction in which we're going this week with our guest. Fleet Street giant, Andy. When I started out, 18, 19, I was that messenger, that photographer's messenger, really, working for an agency in London called Haters, Reg Hater.
That's right,
Who'd seen the future, and we used to provide copy. Stories, cover for the big boys. I mean, a Saturday afternoon for me would probably be three runners, which to describe a runner is an updated match report so that it goes straight in. What was the pink or the green un or whatever else at 5-5? You got a match report.
Mm.
It was just an updated series of paragraphs really on what had happened. So three of those probably, three rewrites when it's all over so that there's a more balanced view of it all. Couple of radio pieces to local radio. Service World of Sport and Grandstand with scores. That's how they got their scores. Yeah. There was no other way in those days. Waited for a phone call. And then service half a dozen of the big beasts in Fleet Street, of which Steve Curry was one. Miss Steve. One day I'll tell the story how Harry Redknapp ended Steve Curry's career, but not right now.
No.
But Steve Curry was one. Brian Glanville, whom Bob Paisley deeply disliked. I'm sorry, Brian, if you're listening. He even left a carriage, Andy, and a railway trip back from Ipswich to London because I'm not sitting in there with that bloody Brian Granville. And he came in and sat with me, Jimmy Case, Ray Kennedy, a whole host of others. And I thought, oh, God, that's the end of that then. But no, these guys were giants.
And
when Fleet Street was proper. And amongst them was our guest today who – well, if Bob had a closer confidant in the press, I don't know who it was, and he was also a very good mate personally. And that gentleman is the former Daily Mail chief football writer,
right?
Now turned his hand to boxing, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to spending time in his company, Andy.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you for joining us, Jeff. I honestly, I've been looking forward to this since you agreed some 48 hours ago. I think this will be good, Andy.
Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted. Yeah, it's been great to listen to you, Jeff.
Jeff.
Yeah, pleasure for me too, guys.
Well, it's... I've been... Let me...
So where are you going to start, Keezy? I ask you, where are you going to start with this? Because the word I've always liked to describe journalists like Jeff are... Fleet Street heavyweight.
I mean, absolutely.
That's got power to it.
Let me.
So where do we start?
Let me rip right through the early days,
you're
Jeff.
Not, hold on. You're not fat shaming me, Andy. No. No.
I am not, Jeff. I am not.
Yes. Welcome to 2021, Jeff. So, East End boy, not very good at school, had a talent for writing, wrote to 98 different newspapers before the Walthamstow Bugle or whatever it was said, yes, come and work for us because we don't have to put you up in accommodation. Occasionally would turn out for the local team because they didn't have enough numbers and somehow managed to get a fabulous job on the Daily Mail. Would that be correct? Have I missed anything out?
That's all good so far. That's absolutely spot on.
But along the way...
Right, question. Question, Keithy. As a footballer then, Jeff, what position were you? What did you play?
Oh, that's a very good
question. I played either as a rather short second centre-half or as the hacker in midfield just in front of him.
Well, hacker, that's appropriate, isn't it?
Spot on.
But Andy, the twist in the tale is he had to pass judgment on the team from 1 to 11 in the following newspaper article. So he was critiquing his own game. How did that go, Jeff?
Well, for a chap called Dave Branton, who I was the ringer for, it wasn't very good because he had a terrible game. I probably played quite well, but he was awful. And he was a good lad too. So it was a shame. It was his most disappointing appearance of the season.
Pressure got to him, Jeff.
Yeah.
So along the way, Jeff, and I hate to mention it because he was my first hero, and when I first thought about asking you to join us this week, I was thinking about Ali Frazier, the 50th anniversary last Monday. Yeah, I was thinking Tyson Fury, and you know, but I kind of have changed my mind. I just want to stay in that era because this podcast, I like to think, Jeff, is more Radio 2 than anything else. So we've got a generation that kind of grew up with us that are loyal and join in. So I don't make any apologies for staying in that place. So how did you get from Walthamstow then to the Daily Mail? And, as I said, or was about to, met a certain Bobby Moore along the way.
Well, being an East End boy as well, I kind of grew up around those people. The journey from the Walthamstow Garden, as it was, that area of East London was quite fertile ground for sort of thrusting young journos who wanted to get on. It was quite competitive among the local papers. And there was a good track record of guys from that area of London progressing to Fleet Street, and I became part of that chain. A very great former sport. I was ended up sports editor of that paper, and a former sports editor, the late and great Ken Wilson, was on the Mail, and he sort of asked me to go in and start doing casual shifts. So I was in the end like almost doing two jobs. I was sports editor of that paper, and then working at nights on the Mail, and then eventually they took me on full time
as football reporter.
No, as a sub editor, and I sort of rose up the ranks of that quite quickly. But I was always doing pieces and writing as well, and I wanted to get out on the road, so I became a football reporter quite quickly, and then eventually football writer for many years.
Yeah. Do you think, Jeff, were you always, even as a youngster, did you always think you had a good, were you a good judge of football? Were you a good judge of sport? Did you think you were, even at a young age?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I loved sport, played a lot of sports. I guess you got steeped in it. My grandfather had played for Bury in their heyday. And also for Lancashire cricket. My father was a boxing fanatic. He liked fighting. He did a lot of it in the Second World War. I grew up with sport. And my father was travelling for work after the war all over the country as a scaffolder. So I got goodness knows how many schools and obviously a very fractured education. But sport was always a constant. Was I a good judge? I don't know. As I went along, I was fortunate enough to run across a lot of important people in football. Mm-hmm. Dave Sexton, who was a brilliant manager, very thoughtful coach, very innovative coach. I was covering Leighton Orient, and Dave was manager of Orient. We used to go on the long bus rides to the away matches in the lower division. So you'd go on about a 5-hour bus ride to Scunthorpe or somewhere.
Wow.
And I used to sit next to Dave and pick his brains relentlessly. And so the more people you spoke to, the more cute you got about, say, football, for example. So that was good. There was Ron Greenwood and his and his sherry parties after matches, which would go on into the small hours sometimes at West Ham.
Sherry parties, Jeff. So, sherry parties.
Sherry, yes.
Really?
Robin used to invite those who he did not include in his description to his players that the press were serpents trying to get under the door. those of us to whom he opened the door were treated to Ron's sherries. And so that was great. And your knowledge expanded as you go along and you talk to more and more people. I mean, there were long nights into the wee hours with the likes of Brian Clough. And so on and so forth.
No, Jeff, can't do so on and so forth because as you talk, see, I my eyes were opened by you fellas. I wanted to be part of that set. I was desperately keen, apart from the night at Stamford Bridge when Big Curry screamed, "Where's the fucking haters, man?" with the quotes. And I'm thinking, geez, I've even got these telephones back in the box yet. Hold on. but I wanted to be part of that. And if we worked in a different era, but I am envious of you guys. You just threw a couple in that Shankly, Clough, Greenwood. And the relationship you guys had with them was different, wasn't it? I mean, there's another one.
It was different with everybody, the players included, because we used to travel together all the time, be it with the club or be it with England. Mm. You all travel together. You went to the bar together. You had a sort of understanding that you didn't overstep the line with nonsensical revelations about whether somebody had a drink in a bar after a game or whatever. And in fact, it would have been pretty hypocritical to do so since you were drinking yes. with them and buying the drinks for them. And Andy will remember that we had a few collisions of that variety down the years.
Oh, yes.
As we did with everybody. And there was an element of trust and understanding. And, you know, when I was lucky enough to pick up the odd award here and there, you'd always be asked, what were key elements of it for young journalists? And I've always said, do not bow to the pressure to betray a confidence or a contact for something scandalous or sensationalist, because if you don't do that, you will end up getting the really great stories. But if you betray them, you'll be persona non grata, and that would be that.
Agreed.
And there is a lot. There's more pressure these days for the cheap story of the moment than there's ever been.
Yes.
And it's difficult
yes,
for the younger
absolutely.
Guys, and they also don't have the same contact and access to the players. I mean, someone mentioned to me in the office the other day, "Oh, well, that guy, you know, he's got a lot of PR contacts." Well, yeah, but that guy hardly ever speaks to a footballer, you know.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
You know, that's how the game's changed.
What were they like, Jeff? Clough, Reavy, there's another one. Bertie, it must have been fascinating spending time with these boys.
Well, you know, Cloughy, I mean, I recall one European Cup tie with Forrest. And we went in for the usual very significant amount of drink with Brian after the game. That was on the Wednesday night. And then we sort of Thursday, as the sun rose on Thursday morning, went to go across to the hotel just across the way from the ground there at the time, picked up the bag. And he said, "Well, come back for a heart starter." So I went back on just having written a piece at just about Thursday lunchtime. And finally got home at 3 o'clock Friday afternoon.
That was a fairly
decent social occasion. But again, it was pretty revealing about what Brian's thoughts were about the game and so on. With Don Reavy, I was fortunate, I got to know him extremely well in times at Leeds and then with England, and he gave me the story. The world exclusive, as we say in the modern parlance, of his resigning as England manager and going off to the Middle East. So
I remember that, yeah.
And I kept a lot of confidences for Don, as for many people down the years. and that one paid off big time. So
just on that, Jeff. Just on that,
it's a question of how you conduct yourself,
of
really.
Of course, but on the Reavy, I mean, I think I'm a voice in the wilderness here, Andy, as well, in many respects. I like Don, and I don't think he ever got enough credit for putting that magnificent side together. But is it the case he was getting the sack anyway, and that's why he left?
Yes, absolutely. He knew he was going to be axed. The chairman of the Football Association at the time, Professor Sir Harold Thompson, just didn't get on with him at all, and it was a lot of very odd reasons for that. None of them of any detriment to Don. Yeah, and the offer came from Dubai, and he had to consider his family. He knew that his time was up, and he just made a decision to, being a great family man as he was, with his own family and with his players at Leeds. And he said, you know, I've got to ensure everybody's future, and it's not going to be popular, and I know that there'll be criticism for it, but I've got to think of us first, which he did.
Well, if you're listening, Don, I didn't at the time, couldn't understand it as a young man, but as time's moved on, absolutely, 100%.
A wonderful guy, very generous guy. I mean, and as you know, his Leeds players, you know, would have died for him.
Yeah, they would have, wouldn't they, just Jeff? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did football turn its back on Bob, Jeff?
On
Bobby.
On Bobby. Well. There was a feeling of the people who ran the game and the people who played it, they considered to be muddied oafs, by and large. You know, the first of the Blazer generation. I mean, it's interesting to recall that Alf Ramsey was the first England manager who was allowed to pick the team.
Yes.
Wow.
The amazing thought, isn't it, for these day and age? Mm. And his predecessors. Were presented with the team by the senior international committee after their very learned deliberations, and then tried to make the best of it. when you've got sort of four left backs, three goalkeepers, and two centre halves, it's a bit difficult to juggle it into a team that's going to win a World Cup. So there you went. Bobby was sort of on the back end of that era, if you like, of mismanagement by the FA. Became, of course, Ramsey's man, and his contribution as a player was enormous. Was based on a computer of a football mind. He was, you know, mega chips in front of everybody in positioning, knowing where to be, where the ball was going to go when he got it. A classic example being the last of Jeff Hurst's hat-trick goals in the World Cup final.
Yeah.
When he was screaming and hit the ball in the stand. Bobby just looked around, pulled it down, hit it a mere 50 or 60 yards, and Jeff blasted it into the net. While everyone was expecting him to sort of play the ball out anywhere, here was a great football brain. And in their wisdom, the FA decided not to use him as I would have thought he would have made a great defensive coach for England. But also, he was, when he didn't have a job and Terry Venables took him to Crystal Palace, and he was working with the youth team there. He was quite brilliant with it. He was actually the youngest player to get the full FA coaching badge at the time. Mm-hmm. All that was overlooked. There were instances where he could have had good jobs, and some people who had taken a disliking to him in the higher echelons of the game spoiled things for him. I got a phone call at 7 o'clock one morning from Elton John, who had been on England trips with us and so on and so forth. Was there any chance I could get Bobby Moore to be manager of Watford? So I said I thought that was possible. We arranged a lunch at a hotel on the banks of the Thames. We went to the lunch. They chatted. It all went very well. I left that part of the conversation to get a drink at the bar, of course, while they sorted out.
Well, absolutely.
Yes.
While they put people together, thusly what, Jeff? I mean, come on.
And while they sorted out the money and came back, and everything was pretty much done, so the hands were shaken, and off they went. And then there was radio silence, nothing from Elton. I couldn't get a call through to him after 4 or 5 weeks to see what was happening, nor could Bobby. He eventually and then he appointed Graham Taylor, who was, of course, very much an FA creature. And of course, yes. he did a terrific job within what I regarded as his rather constricted playing style. But he did a magnificent job for Watford in that context. But the fact of the matter was that Elton had agreed and shaken hands on giving Bobby the job. Now, Graham was, very much allied to the FA coaching scheme and style of play and style of person. And it was pretty evident that somebody had said to somebody at Watford, "Oh, I'm not sure you want Bobby. He's a big time Charlie," which, of course, as a human being, he wasn't. He was a very modest guy. And the poison was put in, and Graham was recommended. Now, it worked out well enough for Elton, but that was one of several serious disappointments for Bobby at the time when he should have been getting a job and making a name for himself as a football manager.
I just used that phrase, Jeff, turn its back. I didn't realise that actually that really was the case. That you're saying there was almost a campaign to keep him out?
Not a campaign, a kind of insidious kind of, and also supercilious way of regarding, one of the greatest players of all time. And there was always a sort of bit of a resentment among the officialdom about players. And Bobby represented the peak of players at that time, the only World Cup winning captain. Very handsome guy. He conducted himself well at all times. I mean, Bobby was always amenable to anybody who approached him, and always charming. But there was something afoot with regard. Perhaps they thought, and this nagged at both of us until Bobby eventually died, that there was a bit of a fear that, you know, he could possibly have become a larger figure in football than the Blazers themselves. I think one most likely to do that.
Do you know what? I think you're probably right there. Andy, he might have been a very handsome young man, Bobby Moore. But as we all know, when you go out on the pull, as we used to call it, you need to go with someone that you know you can trust, a good wingman. The scenario, East End, two teenagers out on the town together, and they got knocked back late on in the old-fashioned disco. Bobby Moore and the other one was, who was the other one, Jeff? Jeff Powell, I think. Yeah, it was.
I didn't get beyond kicking people up in the air on Hackney Marshes. I mean, what the hell happened there?
Fantastic.
Listen, there's this beautiful piece you wrote on the 25th anniversary of us losing Bob, and this really stuck out at me. You talk about, you know, he never said why me. Never said it wasn't about to start now. This is a lunch you had 60 hours, I think, before he died. We talked of the good times, of West Ham days and London nights, of running on holiday beaches, of dinners with Pelé and Beckenbauer, Best and Cruyff, Eusebio and Carlos Alberto, Venables and Menotti. I mean, wow, extraordinary.
Well, they were remarkable times. I recall Italian 90. Pelé was in town. I was there with Bobby, knocking around at the weekend of the final. A great mutual friend of ours.
Pelé was in town, knocking around. A friend of Menotti's. To see that, wonderful.
Yeah. And so, it was arranged that we'd have dinner. The night before the game, two nights before the game, and we went to this great Italian restaurant, which you expect a great Italian restaurant in Rome. Mm. And Pelé came in, and the two of them, as they always did when they met each other, embraced. And we sat there until about, I don't know, 4 a.m, chatting and what have you. And it was all, that was just wonderful, really. Wherever we went, we sort of mixed with like football people and had a wonderful time. I was very privileged in that way, perhaps more so than some of the chaps. And Bobby was obviously an entree to that. But then we go back to when we first met, when we were in the Ilford Palais, in Palais de Danse in East London. And I was here with this great, a handsome sort of rising guy coming up at West Ham. And but neither of us perhaps quite as bumptious as I've become, and we stood at the side. We stood to the side of that, you know, the old silver ball with all the lights burning went round the old.
Oh yes, thing I remember those.
And neither of us could sort of pluck up the courage to go and ask a girl to dance. So we stood there like a couple of dopey wallflowers. I mean, imagine if you'd fast forward it that, like maybe 10 years, and the local fauna had seen Bobby Moore standing there, he wouldn't be able to get off the floor. But that's how we started out, thinking, are we ever going to be able to pull a bird? I mean, it was unbelievable.
Oh dear.
The article, Jeff, or a number, you posed the question: had Bob lived another 25 years? What trouble would we have got into? Do you have an answer to that question?
Probably, but perhaps not one I'd like to print, really. It might have made our domestic life a bit more problematic because, long nights with the can of beers popping. Don't lead to sort of harmony at home always, do they?
Jeff, what does the phrase coming through mean to you?
That's what Bobby would always say. If he was a great insomniac. And in a single period of, this is something he always used if he was going to come and see somebody. He'd go out and say, right, coming through, if he was coming up from out in Chingford into town to meet up, it would be coming through. But it became particularly prevalent for us because I was living in a bachelor pad in London, and he was parked outside. I think it was in Putney at the time, and he would not be able to sleep. So the phone would ring at 4 or 5 in the morning, just coming through. Okay, so I'd sort of pull on some rags, and he'd ring the bell, having driven up, and I had a little balcony which overlooked a church square in around Gloucester Road, and so we'd go out and sit on the balcony, whatever the weather, and have a few drinks, and the sun would come up, and there was a church in this square. And the vicar would come out doing his rounds around the church, open the doors and whatever, and would look up at us, perched on the balcony at sort of 7 o'clock. And Bobby would always say, good morning, vicar. And the guy would go.
You will know this, Jeff. For those who don't, I have to share this because I can imagine that scene. Well, I can't imagine that scene, but when he's under house arrest with the chairman of the Colombian Football Association, receiving calls from family, phone rings, and at the other end of it is Kenny Lynch, and Kenny's told family only, and Kenny says, "Well, I'm his brother." Yeah. He said, "What, called Lynch?" He said, "Stage name." And he said, "Thank God he couldn't see me," but he said, "I got through to Bob." Bobby said, "Well, Christ's sake, don't come out here. I'll get 10 years if you turn up."
Lynch.
It happens with different people. I mean, I recall when George Best was somewhat scandalously arrested, to be honest, and was put on trial, and So, I mean, quite sadly, there were only two people who agreed to give a character witness for him. That was myself and the late Hugh McElvanny, a journalist colleague, which many people will remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went across the bridge from Fleet Street. Well, I walked across the bridge to the Crown Court, the other side, and we sat there. And we were both called to give reference to him and what a wonderful guy he was, and say it was crazy that he would be sent to prison. He didn't have a bad bone in his body, and so on.
He didn't.
Lovely guy, George. And then he got sentenced, and as he sort of got up and was being led away from the court, he went to the officer, just one moment, and he walked over to Hugh and I and said, "Oh, guys, if you hadn't given evidence to me, I'd have got probation."
Dear.
So there you went. No, George was amazing. There was a little bar just off Pall Mall, which I used to meet him at from time to time. And this guy had been cast. Yeah, he liked to drink. Yeah, he being probably the most handsome man you'd meet in your life.
Yeah,
he had a way with women. So we went into this bar at after a game about sort of 6:30 one afternoon, Fulham game, and it was a little tiny place. And so we were standing there, and this rather grumpy looking guy was sitting at the one little table in the corner. And you remember those old-fashioned beer glasses which looked like sort of small window panes? You remember those big heavy ones?
Yes,
with the handle. Right,
yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this guy's got a beer full in one of these, and he just came over, walked across, and smashed George on the back of the head with it.
What?
Which was a pleasant moment. And so, I jumped on this guy, the manager leapt over the bar, and we pinned him down. What are you doing? George Best, he's an asshole and what have you. And it was incomprehensible. The barmaid was patching him up, blood pouring out of his head. The police were called, and the officers came in and they took statements. Of course, their first reaction was, "Oh, George has been in a fight again." But we managed to disabuse them of that prejudice. And then finally, they said, "Well, Mr. Best, what do you want to do about this? Do you want to press charges?" And he just looked at the guy and he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." He said, "I feel sorry for you. You need help." And that was his only response to it.
I mean, that
was Bestie, yeah.
I didn't have the intimate moments with him that you did, Jeff, but the time I spent with George, I concur. I mean, just a lovely, lovely guy with an illness, with
absolutely
a problem he couldn't control. And it was such a terrible shame. But as a person, absolute gent. No question.
Sweetheart.
I'm glad we didn't talk about Ali and Joshua or anything else, Jeff, but I knew I'd enjoy myself, and I can't thank you enough. I always say this, people that go out of their way to talk to myself and Andy, it's great. I mean, I could do this longer, but I'm afraid we have to work to timings. But thank you, Jeff.
Well, I've got an idea, Richard.
Well, that's okay.
The good thing about Jeff, the good thing about having you on, and the reason we never touched boxing is, we can always get you back on and touch on all those
there
subjects.
You go. That's good.
Well, yeah, but
I think we probably should end it now because, I've only just got in and I need to set an hour or two before I go to the office.
One last Bobby Moore. As a young Coventry fan, I can see it now. They come to Coventry. I can't work out for an hour why it is that we keep putting the ball on his head. I'm thinking to myself, why don't we play it somewhere else? Every time we play a ball in, we put it on his head. And of course, it was years later I realised that that's what Bob did. He knew what was happening, didn't he? And he was there to stop
absolutely
it before it did. It was a wonderful, wonderful guy as well. Wonderful guy. Jeff Powell.
He was a human commute and a wonderful guy.
And there's one thing I hope you noticed, Jeff, one thing we haven't spoken about. It's been discussed too often and it hung around his neck forever and a day. And with respect to Bob, that's why we haven't.
Correct. So, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jeff.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, Andy. Cheers, Rich. Bye. Bye.
Absolutely wonderful. And can you picture that scene, brilliant. Andy? Gloucester Square, 7 a.m. on any given day of the week. Jeff Powell and Bobby Moore sat on a balcony having a glass of something, whatever that may have been at that time. Entirely different age, wasn't it? Entirely different age.
Totally. I want to ask him, really. Do you think, I'll ask you, do you think, because you're a journalist, or are a journalist, son. You're doing well. Yeah. You are a journalist.
Thank you,
don't lose it.
Thank you.
But I'm just thinking, do you think there are relationships like that now in the modern game?
Very, very good question. No.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I think
there was lots of them in those days, weren't there?
Yeah, we all.
I mean, you had it. You had it a bit, didn't you?
Absolutely.
You had it a bit in Merseyside.
Yes, yes. Because I mean, Jeff's right. You know, if somebody got into trouble, if you could find a way around it so that it didn't surface, that was your primary job. Not as is the case these days, to get it out as a piece of clickbait and follow up in the blink of an eye. And that's why. I mean, I think he alluded to that with the Don Revy story. That's why when the big one came, Don trusted him with it. And it's different now. It really is. But I, Bob for me, one of my first footballing heroes, and could talk about him all day.
Yeah.
Really could. One thing we haven't spoken about, my friend, is how's your knee?
We're getting this. That's 2 weeks tomorrow since the op, and slowly, because having had plenty of injuries. And plenty. This is probably the biggest that I've had in that respect. So I ain't rushing it. I'm not going to rush it. Easy at my age.
No.
But I'm hoping if I continue to progress that I'll hopefully be back with you by the end of the month. That's my plan anyway.
Said to you from the start, Andy, we're too old now to be cutting corners. We need to do things properly. Whatever's left.
Oh, absolutely.
We want to enjoy it. We want to enjoy it as best we can. Anyway, thanks again to Jeff Powell. As I said, partway through, we are what I think we're Radio 2, Andy, aren't we? We're not youthful. So those of you who have joined and enjoy what we do, thank you for that. You can get in touch on Insta and Twitter at Keys and Gray Pod. Please subscribe on whatever platform you get your pods and share and tell others, obviously. And we look forward very much to spending time with you next week. In the meantime, Andy, look after yourself. Talk in the week.
Talk to you soon, pal.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.